Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the Hall of Famer, the difference maker, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Great, thanks, Sean. Great to see you again.
Great to see you. And Tony, this is one of the rare opportunities. It's just me and you, because we're reviewing, and it says seven CIS experts, 2026 cybersecurity predictions. Although I'm included, so it's six CIS experts and Sean with predictions. So we'll start, Tony, with one I threw in. So I was early because I needed to get this in, because I don't think anybody's been talking about this one. And it's AI, Tony. I don't know that anybody's been talking about AI.
Way to come from left field, Sean.
Exactly. Always thinking, you know, that thought leadership training's really coming off, Tony. You're rubbing off on me here. But AI, obviously, is, I think we've started to realize that potentially future business operations and capabilities are fundamentally different in this new age, as it were. And there's many predictions coming from what work will look like in the future and things of that nature. And we've, Representative Tony, you know, we've seen these elements. And, you know, I go back to where really early in the days where calculators were brought in. Well, there's no need for mathematicians anymore. We've got calculators now. Not quite. We'll always find something to do. But Tony, AI and your thoughts.
Oh my gosh, such a giant topic, and I'm sure we'll come back to it in some of the other predictions. But yeah, it is astounding, and the rise in interest, experimentation, usage. And I don't know if I've ever run this one by you, Sean, but I have an old saying, never underestimate the power of cheap and easy. And you know that in cyber, it's cheap, price always wins, or economics always wins. Security is expensive, hard to explain, complicated. And, you know, I dabble, I'll say, in expert systems and some other things. I mean, way back, you know, in the 80s, when the first kind of round of these things came. And for things like medical diagnoses and, you know, sort of straightforward kinds of problems. And it was interesting, but sort of toys. And a lot of it was very specialized, not accessible to the public. You had to specialty tools, specialty understanding. What's really changed here in the last few years is cheap and easy. It's accessible, right? They may be complex under the hood, but individuals can get to them, can experiment, can see something positive that happens, which encourages more experimentation, which encourages more investment, which encourages more development. And it's just an explosion of interest here. And, you know, one of the things, I mean, there's plenty of topics, but one that strikes me, and we're doing a lot of looking at this now, you know, having grown up in the cyber defense business, and you know what this world is like, Sean, there is so much grunt work in cyber defense. The output of tools, moving stuff from A to B and correlating from A to Z across multiple sensors and inputs and reformatting data and just that kind of stuff that we pay human beings to do that have felt like they're well within reach of technology. And I think that's where a lot of people are looking. And I think there's great opportunity for defense. And I think that's, you know, again, taking grunt work out of the hands so that humans can do human worthy work, I think is a really important theme. On the flip side is the attack business. And you've also heard me say before, I'm sure, if you want to study capitalism, you don't study the good guys, you study the bad guys. So their motivation is cleaner, and they're more naturally to do things that we associate with capitalism, specialization, right, cost management, and so forth. And so you see it naturally. They know what they're trying to do. Hey, I'm not going to build a botnet. I'm going to rent time. I'm not going to build tools. I'm going to buy them. The reconnaissance I can buy, you know, the monetization I can outsource to someone else. So the opportunities for bad guys are sort of more immediate, and I think we're already seeing that, you know, in the nature of you know, the phishing, the scale at which attackers can operate, right? Essentially zero incremental cost above what they were already spending to get much greater scale. So I think it's going to be like a lot of things in security. You'll see the bad guys early. They don't allow themselves to be encumbered by things like law, policy, cranky users. so that's what we're going to get. Is we're going to get bad guys first. But I'm really excited, and I think we hope the next year or two at CIS will bear that out, that there's great opportunities for defense also.
Agreed. And it's another one that I had gone into, Tony, with what we're seeing in terms of, cuts to cybersecurity from a federal perspective, and then also support for state, local, tribal, and territorial, the focused and specific threats to critical infrastructure at a time when necessarily there's a lack of support, a lack of ability to confront both. We saw talent shortages, we needed preparation activities, and all with a lack of funding, really puts, I think, SLTTs in a very precarious position, i.e. why we've, established the membership model. I think it's so important that we start focusing on the cyber underserved in this area as well.
No, I think you're right. And there's certainly great opportunity there because there's so many of them. You can, whatever numbers you look at, Small Business Administration, whatever, right? The small enterprises make up the majority of our economy. And, it is, in the rural area I live in, most service practitioners are very small companies. And their IT providers are small companies servicing small companies. And they just don't have the resources, the time, the ability to think of this in a traditional security way. And, by hiring smart people, downloading great content, training on the expensive tools, those things just are not going to happen by themselves. So there's a mix of, what does it make sense for us to ask of small enterprises to do? But what should we be doing at a more of an aggregate level, right? Through the managed service providers, that's a big theme for CIS, through public policy, through incentives, through insurance, those kinds of activities, which again, with better technology and yes, the ever-present AI, we have the ability to think at a much greater scale about those kinds of activities. But, it's one of the reasons, you referenced one of the most used phrases here at the leadership team at CIS, the cyber underserved. Most of our economy cannot participate in a sort of traditional do-it-yourself model of security. And that's just where we are, right? And so the changes in federal funding and so forth just have made that much, much clearer and much worse. So I think there is we at CIS, that's part of what we do, is to think about these things from both an individual enterprise, but also an ecosystem level. And what can we do to support state, local governments, who are faced with these kinds of constraints and lack of manpower or lack of funding, and so forth. So, and, it, the exciting thing is that I think it's always been true for us at CIS. We think that there are great opportunities, right? There's a tendency to think of everyone's kind of defending themselves in cybersecurity. How does this enterprise get better? How do they train their people to be aware of phishing and all that stuff? Yes, you have to do some of that. But the real value is that most enterprises face essentially the same kinds of problems, living on the same network, using essentially the same technology. And so there's opportunities for large scale collective action, but it might not be at every individual enterprise, right? It might be at the aggregate level, service provider level, incentives. So but I think you're right. It's just so much more important than ever for the sort of collective defense. The founding of the ISAC was about, putting our heads together, not just sharing things, being nice and let's swap stories about how I got head, so maybe it'll help you. It's really about collective defense, right? That if we are similarly situated, whether it's elections or public services or whatever the topic is, and therefore there's a commonality in both mission and purpose and threat, and then that gives us the opportunity for collective action.
Agreed. It puts us in you know, this position where we're starting to rethink alignment of both our, you know, our thought leadership, our ability to collaborate, and then bringing a platform in which collaboration is enhanced through the products and services and an awareness. Because that's, you know, one of the big things I see, Tony, and again, not to dwell on the topic, but is a need to recognize awareness in the space to understand the threats helps you, one, now conceptualize risk, conceptualize the need for control, how much control, no problem. We can help you in that space in order to define an IG1, an IG2, an IG3 of the controls. And here are places that you can start to fundamentally change your perspective on what security is. Not a technology risk, but that business, that state, local, tribal, and territorial risk that is required to have some control. Because if you're not going to control it, then you put it in the hands of the attackers who will take advantage, and then they control it. And that's not where you want to be. So yeah, anyway, not to dwell. Now, before we move into Don's prediction, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Happy 25 years, CIS. Back in 2000, a bunch of experts from government, academia, and private industry met at the Cosmos Club in DC.
Their mission was clear: help local communities, businesses, government, and critical infrastructure defend against cyber threats, regardless of budget or expertise.
CIS was born to fulfill that mission.
So, Tony, how have we done so far?
Well, let's take a look at the numbers. We detected and mitigated close to 320,000 cyber events protecting public and private sector organizations.
We also blocked over 3 trillion potential connections to known malicious, suspicious, or otherwise risky sites in defense of critical infrastructure.
In 2024 alone, our guides received 1.5 million downloads for their straightforward, actionable security guidance.
And let's not forget 150 episodes of Cybersecurity Where You Are.
Certainly unforgettable, of course not. And honestly, Sean, that's just the beginning.
Absolutely. It's been an incredible 25 years. We're just getting started.
The future of cybersecurity is evolving fast, and so are we at CIS.
We may not have all the answers yet,
but we've got the right people, the right mission, and a global community behind us.
So here's to the next 25 years of innovation, collaboration, and impact.
Join us on the journey at cisecurity.org.
But now we move on to Don Freely. Don has been on the show. He's our VP of IT services. And he's taken the stance of refocusing on the practices of operational security. Going to the point of operational security fundamentals. He's getting back to patch management, vulnerability assessment, mitigating attack, privileged access policies. Because what he's saying, and it goes to something that you'd mentioned, is AI. AI is enabling the attackers. He even brings up some research where vendor security patches and update notices are being reverse engineered so that those who aren't patching, now they have an exploit against what was being patched through the research, through the enablement in this space. And he's moving towards and really providing thoughts and zero trust principles and evolving to a CI/CD approach for higher severity vulnerabilities versus a patching window, which, again, through testing can take days, weeks, months, potentially, if they're not if the bulletin itself has not identified a significant vulnerability. So those can dwell, as it were, in that patch cycle. But very interesting from Don.
No, I think you're right. And, you know, these are some of the issues I know you grapple with for us, CIS, as an enterprise, right? That, you know, in some sense, what you're designing an entire system at once, right? So this patching, why would you have a patch window? Well, because you believe the adversary is operating to quickly reverse engineer the patch and has a window of opportunity, right, to understand the flaw, craft an exploit, distribute it, get it in place before you can put in place the patch. So you're always operating in time, right? There's always an element of time here. And being able to do that quickly is a tremendous advantage for the attacker, but, you know, also one that we should be able to do better for defense. But you know, the classic question, why don't people configure their systems better and patch quicker? Because obviously it's right. You reduce the attack surface, things are better. Well, because they don't know what the impact is going to be. Things might break. You know, application, mission critical applications might break. But the follow on question that you need to ask is, well, why did they break? Well, because we bought them without really understanding what the runtime environment was going to be from a security perspective. Right. So we didn't say, you know, there's a cycle here that you're trying to break. This is something we grappled with in the defense department, right? Why do things break? Or why don't I do the right thing? Because things break. Why do things break? Well, because I didn't specify before I bring a new piece of software in, I want to make sure that it will operate on a tightened desktop, on Titan servers, right? On something that, you know, reflects the work of something like a CIS benchmark or a hardened image or whatever. It could be a DoD, this is STIG or anything else there. In other words, you want to design a cycle of activity here that says, I know what my hardened system should look like. And I should only introduce software that I believe is compatible with it. I shouldn't just take any piece of software. So if I have it written for me, I buy it from an integrator, I buy it off the marketplace, I want it to know that I will have to do minimal adaptation, right? I won't have to open any ports. I won't have to provide services that I think are risky and so forth. And that's a hard cycle to break because no one of us, no enterprise controls the market enough, right? Is a big enough buyer to sort of make that problem go away, to turn to a Microsoft and say, you got to ship your systems hardened. So that's been kind of the struggle here. But you know, when Don talks about ZT and or Zero Trust and all that, you know, what we're really talking about is the time cycle of how quickly things happen. And AI is obviously the ultimate accelerant here, which has really changed that and made it harder for defenders to deal with this and easier for the attackers. But I don't know if I ever shared with you, I once had it for a little thought piece and shared it with a bunch of DoD senior types, you know, in the Pentagon. And I almost got laughed out of the room, I have to admit that. So I said, imagine the Defense Department as a nimble adopter of technology. Okay, you know, could quickly assess the market, bring new things in, keep them current, updated, patched, and so forth. And number one, that, you know, people thought that's laughable because of the scale. But I said, having observed professional bad guys for a living in my first career at the National Security Agency, a well-run network, right, one that is adaptable, that stays current, that knows when new machines are introduced or things go out of a trusted configuration, it's actually a very hard target. It's expensive for attackers to go after that because they have to be, they, it raises their risk of exposure. It causes them more expense, more time on target, which leads to greater detectability and all that kind of stuff. So there's an advantage to moving quickly. And that's the problem. We've thought about this from one side. That is, you know, if I'm too quick to patch, I could cause breakage. But the other side of that equation, if I'm too slow, I'm creating advantage, right? In fact, I'm losing advantage. I'm giving up potential advantage and I'm giving it to the bad guys. So there's an ongoing, a number of people have written about this and I've given talks on it. If you know the term OODA loop, does that ring a bell, Sean? Mm-hmm. Observe, yes. Orient, decide, right? You were actually always operating in these loops of time and, you know, observing a situation, orienting ourselves. That the classic one is the one you described, which is the reverse engineering of patches. New patch comes out, every system administrator in theory in the world looks at it. Does this apply to me? What might break? And blah, blah, blah. And that there's a time loop associated with that that's different for everybody. But the bad guy's doing the same thing. He's looking at it, goes, hey, if they're going to issue a patch, there's probably a flaw in here somewhere. Let me go dig through this thing, reverse engineer it. Ah, I got it, figured it out. Can I weaponize this? Can I turn it into an exploit? Can I deploy it quickly enough? And history tells us that a good bad guy can do that more quickly than the good guys can. Right, so your goal is not perfection. Your goal is to sort of knowingly manage those loops, right? To raise uncertainty for the other guy, to sort of in effect create his loop to be longer than yours, and there are things you can do. Again, if you have a nimble network, if you're quick, if you recognize change rapidly, and lots of companies, you know, specialize in this sort of change management and visibility, then you actually provide yourself tremendous defensive advantage. And you know, just sort of finishing up my thoughts on Don's point. You know, again, zero trust is not magic either, right? But it is about sort of constantly I'll say maybe the verb is renegotiating trust. You know, I don't presume trust over a period of time. I reestablish it at each transaction, at each new piece of software, each user, each access, each process, in order to, and what you're really doing is you're shrinking down the time window of, right, how valuable is the knowledge that an adversary has about this process, this person, this thing. And if I can make that as small as possible, I actually cause them tremendous grief because they don't like uncertainty either, right? They have their own risk model, you know, so this is the classic arms race of time. And I think Don's focus on fundamentals, right? If you don't get those right, you can never be nimble. You can't change quickly. You can't observe when things go out of whack, when systems go out of, you know, what I think they're configured as, when new unknown users pop into my world. Those are the fundamentals of not necessarily security, but good IT management. And those are foundational to all that. You know, zero trust is not magic you throw in. It's a way of organizing all that activity to common purpose. And, you know, again, this is the world that you have lived in to help us think through all that.
Right. Exactly. And continue.
good news. Job security, right?
Exactly right. Now we move on to Lee Noriega, Executive Director here at CIS. I don't know if we've ever had Lee on the podcast. Maybe we have, but if not, we're going to have to.
Great question. We have to yes, he's
we have to bring him
great
on.
Great character, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, he's got three different areas that he's providing. So one is utilizing AI in cybersecurity operations. Completely agree. I think I and he are definitely aligned in the predictions, at least. He's got a couple more here. One is law enforcement-centric threat intelligence and using a platform in terms of the distribution. I think that's very, very important where we're aligning the physical element and the manifestation with a digital footprint. Very important to start identifying both the investigation, prosecution, coordinated response efforts, where we're looking at integrating the data, the threat intelligence, and utilizing that both from a digital perspective, and then putting that into the real world and utilizing such capability in the space that we've seen from John Cohen, who we've had on the show many times, is really starting to transform the thoughts here from Lee into a practical capability that we're continuing to invest and mature. But Tony, your thoughts there?
Well, you're right. I'm glad Lee brought this one up because, you know, most of our history in computer security has tended to focus on the vulnerability. If you think of a classic risk equation, right, where risk is a function of, you know, vulnerability, threat, and consequence, for example, most of our focus has been either on vulnerability, you know, the attack surface, flaws in software, bad configurations, and that's important. A little bit on threat, you know, the market for this popped up, you know, quite some years ago for understanding threat, you know, kind of model of what the government had been doing. But a lot of the consequence part of this was kind of speculative. You know, we think bad things could happen. If the bad guys had this capability and this intention in this kind of environment, they could cause this to happen. And that's important to understand, but it doesn't have the same urgency as bad guys are actually doing this now to someone that looks like you or to you or to, you know, someone in your industry and using this kind of tradecraft. And being able to connect all that is a much, you know, if you're going to prioritize, right? You know, this is like, for example, the philosophy of the controls that originally started. You know, there's 1,000 things you could do in cybersecurity on any given day, but you can't afford to do them all. So you have to prioritize somewhere. Defense is always about prioritization, right? The life that you have to manage here. So what would you prioritize on? Well, you'd like to prioritize on things that you believe are represent a reality that you have to deal with. Bad guys are really doing this. This vulnerability is being exploited. This other one is not. You know, you've got to find a way to establish some credible, repeatable narrative about prioritization. And I think, you know, this connection to law enforcement, to physical effects, to attempts by bad guys to influence everything from, you know, people's thinking to their behavior, to causing panic economically or by disrupting the 911 system, right? The range of things that bad guys see as worthy outcomes, as mission objectives, is vast. And so being able to intelligently think about consequences and what is really going on out there and how does that reflected, right, is a really important step. And, you know, for our audience, Sean, I mean, we've been involved in these how many hours of these discussions at CIS about, you know, about risks and consequences. And it feels to me like we have been gradually shifting our perspective, right? So it's easier, it's been traditional to talk about, we see the cyber problem, here's our products and services, and where that's going to help people. That's all good. But really starting first with the perspective of decision makers, systems owners, mission owners, policy makers, what are they trying to do? They're trying to conduct their business, conduct their missions with some level of confidence. So conceptually, really what we're trying to do is empower folks like that to take action with a known level of confidence, right? With a belief that what they're doing is prudent, rational, and, you know, will have the desired outcome. And that's a different, it sounds simplistic, but it's actually a really different perspective because it means you have to put what we think of as cybersecurity into their context. What are they trying to accomplish? You know, one of our examples, and we've talked about this on the show, is the Ohio Data Protection Act. Right, it's not about cybersecurity per se. It's about they want to raise the confidence of businesses that do business in Ohio, and if they suffer a breach, they get some safe harbor protection if they have behaved in a reasonable manner. All right, so that enables a business owner to say, "I can remove a big unknown. If I operate in Ohio and I have a breach, I could have astronomical, you know, costs through the regulatory, through the court system." This allows them to manage that, to say, you know what, I can deal with that risk. I believe that I could cap my costs, I could buy insurance to cover the rest, et cetera. And so that perspective then changes both our thinking at CIS, but also our, you know, we might have the same products, but we sort of reframe them in a way that talks to regulatory language and legal, the legal system and so forth. So Lee's point, you know, a lot of the consequences today have to be dealt with through local officials, through law enforcement, safety, emergency management. And these are, you know, incredibly important, right, to our lives as social creatures in the United States. And so at the same time, all of their systems are online. All of their, you know, the constituency they're trying to serve, all of their ability to marshal resources to deal with a flood or to deal with disruptions to critical services are all highly dependent upon technology. And so it's inevitable that bad guys would see, right, the vehicle for causing harm is through all this infrastructure that is, you might call it technology enabled or internet enabled. And so you have to be able to connect them then to say, this is not technology first, this is about our ability to conduct our lives economically, socially, et cetera, and with a huge technical infrastructure that can disrupt that. So I think Lee's point, and again, it's been you know, what you're hearing is a bit of his thinking, his contributions to our corporate discussion, right, about how this affects our thinking as a service provider, as a company who's, you know, a nonprofit whose job, our mission in life is to empower people to operate with confidence. And I think that's, you know, in your job, Sean, you deal a lot with that also, right? So with all the, you know, you have access to a workforce that most companies do not have access to. You've got a board that's particularly tuned to the security problem, probably a stronger budget than a lot of companies in this space. And yet you're not aiming for perfection either, right? You're aiming for some sort of balanced thinking. So I think that point applies to you. You know, how would you then think of real life and prioritization of resources, right? And not only do you want to do the right thing, but you have to convince the board, our stakeholders, our customers, that we are good stewards of their interests.
Absolutely. Well, no, I think that then becomes, you know, a responsibility, as it were, in terms of that transaction. And part of the risk equation is, well, we've identified the risk, but, you know, the value of the control and its implementation and also the burden, you know, what's the counteractive effect of implementing in the strategy that you've defined? And so it goes through negotiation. Like you say, you know, it's starting to identify the threats and what's reasonable and what standard do we need to get? And, you know, we could take a look at, you know, the capability maturity model and getting to optimized and, you know, I've got to get to level 5 on everything. Absolutely not. That it's one would take an inordinate amount of resources to get there, but to continue in that space over a longer period of time, you know, double, triple, quadruple those resources in order to continue that space. And so, like you say, it's an assessment. We need good data such as threat intelligence to be able to identify, you know, where do we have a sense of a true optimized need, and then where can we be managed in other spaces, and that, you know, allows us to balance both the resources we have, because even with a healthy budget, it's not infinite, and I don't have infinite resources either. And so it's then portraying that to the board and to leadership and to our stakeholders as to this is what we do with what we have in order to mitigate that risk to a reasonable level, again, within the space of appetite and tolerance for risk.
Yeah, it's astounding, right? We think of cybersecurity as a technical field, but the amount of time you spend essentially negotiating trust is kind of off the charts.
Exactly.
Which is all about humanity, right? The human behavior and the level of confidence, the creation of evidence. Yep. And the presentation of it, right, in a language that resonates with a board, with a stakeholder, with a customer.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, Lee had two more. And again, we're coming up to time, so I think we're going to have a part two, as we usually do. As we usually do.
Remember, the goal is to wait long enough in the year so that we can be pretty good about it. Oh, yeah, it's a great prediction because it's already come true.
Exactly. Exactly. These may turn into 2027 predictions. But anyway,
all right.
We'll...
All good.
So Lee also identifies zero trust. He's using it as part of compliance mandates, where he's looking at NIST, the NIST framework 800-207, as being part of mandates and integrations, both from a procurement and audit perspective. And he also had another one of the four that he'd identified, which is privacy and cybersecurity converging into a governance model. And seeing that recognized, and internally, we've done a lot of these elements to not be independent. You know, as part of the ISO group, I work very closely with legal in order to bring privacy into our culture. Now, Lee seeing it as, well, a lot of organizations are doing these things separately when they should converge. And he's absolutely right. I couldn't agree more, because privacy... And it's something we talked a long time ago when GDPR first really started to take hold, was there's never really been a cybersecurity regulation. Privacy brought that in and said, well, cybersecurity is part of these, GDPR, CCPA, China's PIPL. These elements are now bringing the security requirement to the table. And it's not just a technology risk, it's a privacy risk. That privacy aligns to data. Therefore, it's a business risk. And highlighting that was, one of the effective implementations of privacy regulation. It really brought a new light to cybersecurity. But where now Lee's looking at those two converging into a required approach, as it were, to govern. You need to be aware of both in order to do it successfully.
Yeah, I think, for the audience here, shameless plug for our reasonable cybersecurity paper. Available through our website. And we looked at that. You know, we were focused on, I'll call it cyber legislation. So legislative language that addresses, you know, some equivalent to, like I mentioned earlier, the Ohio Data Protection Act. And there, you know, there's a handful of states that have something that's roughly of that type, of that model. But we also list in there, I think it's like 18 or so states that have specific privacy legislation, which we think of it's sort of backdoor cyber legislation, right? Because you're going to collect data, and might be for an industry or a type or whatever, but you're expected to protect that data to some level of reasonableness, undefined typically within that language. And so they have the same effect, right? The protecting of data, who has access to it, the control of it over its lifetime, and so forth. And so there's a kind of a logical convergence that Lee speaks to. I think it would be optimistic to think of this as happening anytime in the next year, in 2026. But logically, it makes sense as a sort of a movement. It always felt more chaotic to me than that, right? Because privacy tends to have its own constituency, people that care about it. It might be specialized like medical data or personally identifiable data, or, you know, and so it's not coming from like one sort of coherent thought. It's coming from different places. Different states behave differently because of the influence of political parties or sort of history, track record. Is there a champion for the idea in a particular state because of the industries that are in that state, and so forth? So I forget the quote that Brian DeValance often uses, right? The states are the laboratory of the democracy. You know, it's the place where there's a lot of experimentation, and that's the way it feels now in both cyber legislation and also in privacy. And that's kind of sensible. It's not surprising that we don't have federal, because that tends to be the last. It will tend to lag because these things are happening at the states. States feel more compelled for a variety of reasons, right? It's directly the businesses, you know, that talk to them that are feeling the direct effects. They may care because they have a high tech concentration of industries in their state or whatever. There's just lots of reasons. But I think Lee's idea is sound in that makes a lot of sense. And in some ways we think of it similarly at CIS. And that's why we felt like we had to address that also in that reasonable cybersecurity paper, because, you know, they're so closely aligned. And at the end of the day, it's likely the vast majority of practices that you're trying to encourage are the same, no matter the type of data you're trying to protect. And so, you know, what, again, from a social perspective, it would make sense to move this in lockstep and to not have parallel independent programs. That's just crazy. Crazy expense, crazy repetition, crazy, and different sets of auditors, different sets of requirements, and so forth. The reality is messier. And as I think our audience will know, we're one of the, I think we could say this, Sean, we're one of the few, I'll call it framework owners or, you know, professional advice givers that recognize this kind of problem. And as a consequence, we do something about it, right? We provide cross mappings from our work to basically everybody else's. And it's partly to address this problem, to say you shouldn't have to do double work to deal with both the NIST-CSF and PCI and HIPAA. There's a core set of technical things. Each is different. Some have more, some have less, some are more prescriptive, some are more descriptive. But you really should be focused on, you know, what is my program of security improvement, and be able to talk to it in lots of different languages and frameworks, and represent the same technical changes to different auditors, for example, or regulators and so forth. So I think I like where Lee was going with that. I just maybe see it a little more chaotic than, yeah, you know, than a next year prediction. But I think the trend is the right one, clearly. And absolutely, you know, you have to deal with this, Sean, right?
How much work do you spend?
Yeah, I got 10 frameworks, and they're all asking, you know, this guy's like happy instead of glad, and these guys like red instead of blue, and, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
That must be it must be mind numbing.
It's always fun. Always fun. Well, Tony, that brings us to the end of the episode. So in part two, we have Randy Rose, his predictions, VP of Security Ops and Intelligence. Will, you know, fans of the show certainly know Randy. I think he's on the show more than we are at this point.
Yeah, that's a great breakpoint, because I think that's a really interesting change of pace.
It certainly is. And he actually worked with his intelligence team to come up. He has 7 different predictions that he's reviewing. So that's probably an episode to itself. We have Marcus Sachs, Senior Vice President and Chief Engineer. Really great insight there. Karen Sarardi, VP of MSISAC Strategy and Plans. And then a favorite of the show, Valicia Stichetti, our senior cybersecurity engineer, will be reviewing her predictions as we move into 2026. So,
great lineup. Really interesting opinions out of there, diverse.
Absolutely.
Too.
A great part, okay. Too. Tony, thank you so much, sir. And thank you to our audience. Make sure to subscribe in all the usual ways with your preferred podcast provider. Catch us on YouTube at The CI Security. Make sure to like and subscribe to our channel. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.